Yep, I have got a cold. Still, it is my pleasure to introduce you to, sitting in a BBC studio in London, the sociologist and journalist Anne Karpf, on the topic of her book The Human Voice, subtitled The Story of a Remarkable Talent, in which she highlights its strange kind of invisibility when it comes to our awareness of it in speech and communication. So, Anne, why do you reckon there's so little attention or notice paid to it?
It is fascinating, isn't it? Especially because in the last 10, 15, even 20 years, there's been so much interest and debate in language, in conversational strategies, differences in the way men and women speak. So there's a lot of emphasis on the words we use. And I thought, but we're ignoring the conduit through these words to which these words are articulated, which is the actual embodied physical voice, the instrument that I'm using to speak to you now. And we kind of labour under this delusion, if you like, that we live in a culture where the text and the image are more important than the voice. And that's what I wanted to make a tiny contribution to drawing attention to.
Right. Well, I've been noticing just recently around where I live, someone's advertising a singing class and they're using the tagline, "Find Your Voice." Mm-hmm. And there's something about that appeal which hints at the real you, the inner you, and the very act of creating audible sounds and hearing them is actually a powerful experience, you know, speaking up, that helps to distinguish your sense of self from that of other people.
Yes, I think you've hit the nail on the head there. You know, the whole idea of finding your voice does express some sense of finding, of freeing yourself in some way, of externalizing something powerful from the inside. However, that said, it is interesting that we use voice in that very metaphorical way so often nowadays. So again, that points to the fact that we have slightly lost the sense of the embodied voice. I mean, when you talk about voice to people, they mainly think you're talking either about narrative voice, so, you know, Virginia Woolf's voice in Mrs. Dalloway, for example, or they think you're talking about it in the kind of political empowering sense, you know, this social group needs to find its voice politically. Or particularly in the UK, people think you're talking about accent. I think it was George Bernard Shaw who was supposedly said, no English person can open their mouth without making another English person despise them because of their accent. And I really wasn't interested in any of that. Of course I'm interested in those other aspects, but what I particularly wanted to focus on in my book was this embodied aspect of the voice, the actual physical voice. And I must say that the more I thought about it and researched it and wrote, the less I was persuaded by this idea that we have this single authentic voice. The American performance artist Laurie Anderson said once that we each of us have about 50 different voices. You know, our hailing our cab voice, our talking to our boss voice, our, you know, buying a coffee from the coffee shop voice. In my case, my screaming at my children voice is a particularly powerful one. So I think we all have, you know, a range of voices. We're all kind of multi-voiced, if you like.
Mm-hmm. Well, in its tonal and other qualities that distinguish how we use our voices, there's a kind of a paralanguage, isn't there? And it's been observed that people do communicate a great deal more than the content of the actual words being used when they use their voices, right?
Yes, I mean, it's interesting. One of the people I interviewed for my book, who lived a few hundred miles away from his aging mother, said when he phoned her and she answered the phone, within the first few syllables of her first hello, He could tell how she was feeling, whether she was up, whether she was down, what her mood was. And he then would proceed in the rest of the phone conversation to buoy her up largely through his own voice. And I thought that was a very interesting example of, you know, the communicative potential of paralanguage.
Yeah, yeah. And just using your voice, exchanging small talk, kind of magically creates social bonds too, doesn't it?
Yes, yes. Yeah. No, it's... there's so much that's fascinating about voice. I think, I'll tell you some of the things I found really, really interesting. One is what's known as convergence or accommodation theory. And that is the way, I mean, we've all had the experience. You come into a room and your partner or your child or a friend is on the phone, and you can pretty much guess who they're speaking to because of how they're using their voice. And this theory holds that we adapt our voices to those who are more powerful than us. So there was a study done of the Larry King show on CNN, which was a famous talk show that ran for decades. And it monitored the voices of Larry King and his guests. And it found that the guests who were kind of real A-list guests, you know, the US presidents, the big celebrity stars, Larry King would adapt his voice to theirs and really follow their vocal pattern. But the kind of C-list guests that he had, it was the guests who would adapt to him. And I found that really interesting, that in a way you can map out power relations if you're skilled at listening to the voice.
Well, and you've said in your book that you hope to show how the voice lies at the heart of what it is to be human. And do you mean like with these examples?
Well, I do, but I also mean because we are the only species that has the vocal range that we have, we are the only species that has this kind of both innate ability to speak and to use our voices, but then can make the most remarkable range of tones beyond any other species. I mean, you can start talking about birds and bird song, and it is extraordinary, and there are extraordinary similarities, and you can look at other species, but we are unique in that respect. But also, I mean, what particularly fascinates me is the relationship between parents and babies, and particularly mothers. There is this phenomenon that's known as mother talk or mother ease, which is almost universal. I mean, there are a couple of exceptions of places in the world that don't deploy it. But it is an extraordinary thing, the way we kind of stretch our vowels, for example, and really enlarge our vocal range. So we go, hello, what a sweet little baby. And, you know, there have been learned tomes, volume studies devoted to examining why it originates, what its function is, how long it lasts. And it's a way that we use our voices to make a connection with a baby, and we go on doing so. And so in a way that leads me to what is, I think, one of the main arguments of my book, is that our voices work at their best not when they're the voice beautiful, but when they are at their freest. And that is what we respond to in other people's voices, vitality and aliveness. I think the voice is a very good expression of how alive and vital someone is.
Well, I tell you, that leads straight to the question that I'm dying to ask you, and that is why you got so interested in that. I mean, I know you're a radio critic as well as everything else. I know you've worked in radio too. And I noted that you actually ended your book on the topic of listening. That's where you leave off. Listening is, of course, the even less talked about bit to do with the voice. But where for you is the fascination? What was it that sent you into learning all about this? Was it that pleasure in the vitality of voice?
Do you know, I think it might have been the precise opposite. I grew up in a family where English was not my parents' mother tongue. They were Polish-Jewish Holocaust survivors who came here after the war and sort of learnt English at the same time as we did, me and my sister. So I think that actually the non-verbal aspects of communication were probably extremely important, because although they were very linguistically gifted, and my father spoke 5 or 6 languages and my mother the same, they were, you know, at the beginning of learning English. And they also had very forceful voices. You know, they were survivors in every sense of the word, and they had a very kind of kinetic voice of the use of the voice. They really used their voices to assert their aliveness and their survival. So they had strong voices, both of them.
So when you said then that it was the opposite of the vitality of voice, there was a sort of this mixture then of their learning to use their voice in a particular language and yet a great strength in their voice in another sense.
Yes, I think what couldn't be articulated in the family, because it was too dangerous, too risky, was grief and sadness. And I think that was present in the home but never articulated. And I think that in a probably very unconscious way, I must have picked that up. So my hunch is that some of the sadness got articulated or perhaps buried somewhere in the voice. And maybe that was a factor in my becoming interested in it. I mean, that's purely speculative.
Yeah, but it certainly sounds as though your listening barometer was a bit set by that oral world.
Yes, I think that probably is the case. And, you know, it took me a long time to work out some of what was being expressed through the voice in my own family. So I think that probably interested me, got me interested in the extra linguistic, if you like, paralinguistic aspects of the voice. Then, as you say, for 7 or 8 years I was a radio critic. I do quite a lot of broadcasting myself, and my sister is a voiceover actress. So it was sort of, in a way, coming at me every which way. My husband is also a researcher and writer on community radio. So in a way, it seemed like the obvious subject to me. How could I not write about the voice?
Well,
I should tell you, there was somebody I interviewed for my book who said that they had hired 5 nannies over the course of this woman's children's lives entirely by interviewing them over the phone, that she felt more confident in that she wouldn't be distracted. And she said she'd never made a bad judgment because she was so confident in her ability to read the voice. So that's what I argue in the book. We need to develop our listening and voice reading skills, because they are a fabulous resource.
It's a crazy expression, though, isn't it? Reading a voice.
Yes.
It just struck me.
I mean, it shows you how much enthrall we are to the idea of the text, that when we want to talk about interpretive skills, we immediately reach for, you know, a reading, a literary image rather than an oral audio one.
Yes, I see. The author of The Human Voice, Anne Karpf, and you can find all the publication details of her books on the webpage for this week's Lingua Franca. From me, Maria Zylstra, though.